Thank you very much, Sheila, and good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Al Garner, and I am a member of the Fellowship of Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. Wow, what a neat bunch of faces there is to look at up here this morning. This is great. I thank you very much, the trustees, Milton, Bob, Kevin, for inviting Gay and I up to spend this weekend with you. It's been wonderful. And it was... Blue needs to do a little bit of work on his identification here, I think. But you know, I came in the other night, and Kevin and Blue and several of the guys were sitting up in the lobby early in the morning, and Roe told me the next day that Blue was a little concerned about me because he didn't know if I qualified to be here this weekend. He said he'd been in Atlanta for years and years and years, and he'd never seen me in any meetings down there. Roe came back and told him that I was in Al-Anon. That was the reason he didn't see me. And he got Sheila confused this morning. But, you know, I think that points out a big point as far as I'm concerned, that we're all alike. You know, we can take away the alcohol, and we get inside, and we are all alike. And that was confusing to me when I came to this program, the identification of feelings and those type of things. And they talked about fear, and they talked about all these things that alcoholics talk about when I go to meetings. It was real confusing. And as Gay explained to you last night, I'm not one of those Al-Anons that came and found the way and showed the alcoholic the way. I waited 5 years after Gay got to the program before I got here. And I thank the committee also for placing us on the program, as you have, because, as Sheila said, it gives me the opportunity to straighten out a few things that Gay might have used last night. She walks a thin line between telling my story and meddling sometime, and we have to straighten that out, but. We do appreciate being here this morning, and I'm supposed to tell you what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm like now. And what I was like was real simple. I came here looking for a place to be because I didn't know where I wanted to be. I came here full of total denial. As I said the other week, kind of like the Al-Anon who died and went to hell, and she stood in the middle of hell and she said, "I know it's hell. But it's not hot in here. It's not hot. It's nice. It's nice. It's not hot." You see, I got here with after spending some 44 years of my life looking for a place to belong, not knowing where I belonged, with a family that was a disaster. And if you had asked me that first day when I walked in here how everything was, I'd have told you it was great and it was fine. And it wasn't really hot. It was nice. And I was here to help my alcoholic learn to control her drinking. And we would be in good shape. Didn't turn out to be the case. This alcoholic that I had, we were talking about it the other night. When today her is the birthday of her mother who passed away. And we were talking about that this morning. And she left this world, and she was a real sweet lady, and I loved her very much. She was kind of set in her ways. Gay talked to her about that, described her as describing herself as being a lush last night. She also had a few other shortcomings that we used to we kid about. Gay was from Omaha, Nebraska. Now I'm born in a little town from North Carolina called Roanoke Rapids. In the eastern part of the state. And Gay was from Omaha, Nebraska, and there was a strange group of people. I'm going to relate a few stories here till these butterflies settle down and I'll get started. But this family was a loving, caring, touching family that I had never been a part of before. And her mother used to, until she left this world, used to constantly remind me that the food here in the South is good. The beef in the Southeast is excellent. Your tomatoes are all right in North Carolina, but you really ought to taste the beef from Omaha, Nebraska. You really ought to taste the tomatoes that we grow in Omaha, Nebraska. Well, we moved about in the business I'm in, and we ended up in Knoxville, Tennessee. And we went out and had dinner in a little place called the Brass Rail up in Knoxville. Had the best prime rib I had ever tasted in my life. And I told Gay, I said, I just can't wait till your mother appears. We're going to take her to dinner. So we went to the prime rib at the Brass Rail, and I said, I'll order. And they served the prime rib, and I said, now I want you to tell me that you have had better prime rib in Omaha, Nebraska. She cut into it, and she said, I got to admit, it's as good as I've ever had in Omaha, Nebraska. So all the way through dinner, I kept asking her, how's your prime rib? Is it real good? Good as you get in Omaha, Nebraska? So as we walked out the door, I said to the owner, I said, God, your prime rib is wonderful here. He said, it should be. We fly it all in from Omaha, Nebraska. Yeah, I'm going to knock this off. I'm going to put it down here. But when she left, and I thought about her this morning, I thought about that story. Because when she left this world, she never let me forget that. She fell down on her knees and she said, you need a drink, son, and took me in the bar and we had a drink and laughed about it. Gay explained to you last night that we have four daughters and that alcohol is in our family throughout. It was also in my side of the family, my grandfather was a gutter drunk. And until I got to this program and got into Al-Anon, that was my definition. If you'd asked me what a drunk is, an alcoholic is, I'd have showed you a picture of my grandfather. I had a couple of uncles on my father's side that died as a direct result of alcoholism. A couple of uncles on my mother's side who died as a direct result of alcoholism. And you know, when I look back, these are my favorite people. As I was growing up, I was attracted to these people. I was drawn to these people. And today, it's the same way with me when it comes to an alcoholic. I'm drawn to alcoholics. I love alcoholics. And I came into this world looking for my share of them, and I found a bunch of them. Somebody in my home group, and my home group, by the way, is Steady as a Rock. It meets on Monday night in Stone Mountain, Georgia. If you're ever in that area, I'd love to have you. We have a lot of nice people there, and that's where I've found my serenity, and that's where I've found this program. And these are the people that know me best in that program because I share with them on a daily basis. But when we came to this program, I was not very well aware of what an alcoholic was. And certainly it was not us. It was not my wife. And it was not me, and it was not my family. And even though I had a daughter that had run away, as Gay described last night, to marry her drug dealer, we had a daughter that had to be committed. The denial was great, and I could tell you that there was nothing wrong in our family. Because you see, in our family, we didn't look anything like Pop did, the alcoholic. We had a house, we had a couple of cars, and Gay cast aspersions on the job that I had last night, and that's something else that I need to explain. That you know, even though the IRS and the FBI and any governmental agency that had an initial was after us, it wasn't my problem. It was Gay's because she really didn't understand show business. That's what I told her on a daily basis when this happened, but. With all of these things, this is how I got into, came to this program. That's who I was when I got here. But I started out in North Carolina being really drawn to these aunts and these uncles and this grandfather who all died as a direct result of alcoholism. And I can remember as a child the same feeling that I felt when I walked into the program of Al-Anon. And that feeling of not knowing where I belonged, not knowing what I wanted to do, wanting to be somewhere other than where I am, but not really knowing where that somewhere is, not really belonging, never being enough. And I came through, even as a child, trying to figure out what all the grown-ups wanted me to be, and I would try my best to be that. I'd ask them, I would listen to them talk, and then I would try to be that. And if I wasn't that, I would try to convince you that I was that. So lying became a very big part of my life as a youngster. It was just, I'd lie to you in a minute to create any type of acceptance that I thought I might be able to create. I can remember playing sports as a kid. I was captain of our baseball team in high school and sitting in the locker room with these guys, sitting there thinking that I don't really belong. I'm not a part of this, feeling by myself, wanting to be somewhere else, but not knowing where that place is. I went through school, played sports, never had a real problem in drinking. My family, my mom and dad were separated when I was 3 years old. My mom was a teetotaler. And she impressed upon me the real need for me to do extra work and extra things to turn out to be a young man that she thought I should be. Since I didn't have a father, I was operating at a real deficiency at that point, so I had to try extra hard. And so I tried extra hard, and I tried extra hard to be things that I was not. Mom and I lived together. My grandmother came to live with us, and grandmother was a Pentecostal holiness, and it's a very emotional religion. And I can remember as a youngster being taken to her church and being frightened and scared by this. Mom was remarried for the second time when I was about 9 years old. And this was my first encounter with a real violent type alcoholic. And he was that. The only problem is he didn't really spend enough time to get to know Mother before he married her. And Mother had a reputation around the family as if you weren't real careful, she would hurt you. And this poor suffering alcoholic came in and pretended to be violent, and he lost that battle with Mother real quick. And he left our house, never to return again. Mom was remarried and for the third time and married a very nice man, one that drank very little and provided a good living for us. And we moved about from North Carolina up to Virginia. And when I moved to Virginia, we used to talk about education when I was in college. And I would brag to the guys in college that I completed high school. I was sharp enough to complete high school in 11 years, which I did. I didn't bother to tell them they only had 11 grades in the school in Virginia that I went to, but if it made me sound a little more proficient, that's the story I would tell. I played sports, and as I was graduating from high school, it was determined for me that I was become a Methodist minister. Now, standing here behind this pulpit, you can probably visualize that. I can't. But they sent us off to a retreat with Methodist ministers, prospective ministers and missionaries, and I had a real problem with a thing called the call to the ministry that all these fellows and missionaries and prospective ministers were talking about. So I shared that with one of my counselors, and he said, well, maybe your call to the ministry is if you try to walk away from it and feel drawn back to it, that's your call. So maybe what you ought to try to do is that. So I did. I went home, and he also suggested that I pray a lot about it, and I did. I went home and raised the shades and got down on my knees beside the bed, and I prayed for a sign from God. If you want me to be a minister, let me know. And I looked out the window, and I didn't see any signs. And I continued this process for several weeks, and I saw no signs. So I reached the only conclusion I think that I could reach at that time was that God wasn't interested in me. I wasn't interested in Him. So I went the other way, and I enrolled in military school in North Carolina. This was probably one of the happiest times of my life, because I knew exactly what is expected of me there. I knew what time to get up in the morning. I knew what time to go to bed. I knew what time to study, and I understood what I was supposed to do to receive approval and to be accepted and be a part of. And in 2 years, I graduated that junior college as cadet CO, most outstanding cadet, with a straight A average. And I operated and functioned very well in that structured atmosphere. But left to my own devices to look and find things for myself, I was in trouble, and I transferred to a school in Wake Forest. Now, what had happened at this time in my life, when I graduated from high school, my dad showed up at my graduation. And I don't remember thinking that was particularly significant, but Dad and I had not had a relationship. And I corresponded with him from time to time, but he lived in Florida and I lived in Virginia. My mother had a great deal of resentment for my dad, and I adopted a lot of that resentment. And so we didn't have a relationship. But he showed up at my high school graduation. And then again, when I graduated from military school, he showed up again. And he congratulated me on my honors and said, I want to let you know that I'm going to pay for the rest of your education and send you on to college. And I want you to go down to the University of Miami, and I've checked on it, and I'll pay for everything for you to go. And I said, thank you very much. I appreciate it, but I've come this far in life without your help. I don't need you. I'll go to college myself. Thank you. And thank God he was a bigger man than I at that point, because he said to me, wherever you want to go, I'll be happy to pay for your education. And I went to Wake Forest, enrolled in Wake Forest, and he paid for my education. And I got to know Dad a little bit. We began to talk. I began to visit with him. We still didn't have a relationship of a father and a son. I was kind of distant from Mother. And still belonging and being out there and belonging somewhere I didn't know where. Looking for a place to be and not knowing where it was. Always feeling that wherever I was there by mistake. It wasn't really supposed to be. Didn't know what the answer was, but I felt, and a lot of it I think was justified earlier on. I know when I was enrolled at Wake Forest, I thought for a long time that the vocation that I ended up in was by mistake, because I worked at a college radio station up in Wake Forest, and I was waiting for one of the fellows to get off at the local radio station, and a little fella come running through and said, are you here about the job? And I said, oh yeah. And he said, follow me on in. And I went in the office, and I figured it's somebody clowning around, as they do in radio stations. It turned out to be the president of Winston-Salem Broadcasting, and they explained to me they were looking for a job as a weekend announcer there. And he asked me if I had any experience, and I told him I worked at the college radio station. He said, are you any good? And I said, I'm the best thing they've got. So he listened to me, and I auditioned for the job, and he called me back the next day, and he said, you're not as good as you think you are, but you're good enough to work weekends. And that's how I got in the radio business. So I ran around for years, and until I got to this program, as a matter of fact, thinking that probably the job that I had chosen to make my living in was by mistake. When I went to Wake Forest, as Gay explained to you, that's where I met Gay. And I roomed with a fellow that I had gone to military school with at Wake Forest. And Bob and I roomed together, and he was dating this young girl and had met their family there in Winston-Salem. And I used to hang out with, I didn't have a real girlfriend, so I hung out with Bob and his girlfriend, and her family cooked wonderful home-cooked meals, and it was great to be away at college to go have these meals, and we spent a lot of time at their house. So on a given weekend in our senior year in college, Bob said, I'm going to go try out for the Lost Colony, for a part in the Lost Colony this summer, and would you do me a real favor and see that Gay is occupied while I'm gone to try out for the Lost Colony? And she told you about the Plantation Club in Common Cavalero, and I saw that she was not at all ignored while Bob was gone. And Bob came back, and Bob lost a fiance, and I lost a roommate, and that's how Gay and I met. We dated on through college, and I met her family, and I loved her family. I loved her father and her mother. And I loved the things that they had as a family. There were a lot of things that I didn't identify with readily and I was uncomfortable with in the beginning, but I grew to love them. Gay, as she told you, became pregnant, and it was not acceptable and discussed. We were shipped off down to North Florida, and that's where we were to start our marriage. I'm in a job that I feel like I'm here by mistake. I'm in a marriage that I'm not really sure that I want to be in at this point. And that's the way we started our relationship, and that's the way we started our marriage. It's not a real healthy way to start a relationship. And we were determined, however, we were going to make this relationship work if it killed us. And it doggone did, almost. We moved around a bit. I stayed in the broadcast business, but I got to know my dad a little bit more. And I began to build a relationship with my father that was a little tighter than it was. Began to feel like he was my father. And the harder Gay and I worked at our relationship, the worse that relationship came. The harder we worked, the worse it got. It was a disaster. We had, in short order, three daughters, and we moved about from Florida to Texas to Georgia, and we moved all over the place because you had to relocate to move up in the radio business. I got out to Texas, and an entertainer came in one day when I was at the station out there and said, I like the way you operate, I'm going to buy some radio stations, and you're going to come and run those radio stations for me. I had no idea how to run a radio station. I had trouble working at one, much less ruining one. And I said, fine, let me know when you do. And he did. I got a telegram from him. He'd bought a radio station, offered me the job, and I went to work for him. Built his first radio station in Knoxville, Tennessee. And now I'm into a marriage that I really don't want to be in a vocation that I'm certainly not sure about, and I know I'm there by mistake, and if anybody really finds out what my capabilities are and who I really am, it's going to be all over. And now I'm responsible for other people and responsible for a radio station and finding radio stations and building them. And I was a mess, to say the least. I began to travel a lot. I stayed on the road. I had no idea of what was going on in our home. I had no idea of Gay's drinking and the level of her drinking. I had no idea what was going on with my children at home. I had three daughters, but Gay was there to raise them because I was out busy playing in show business. When we left Knoxville and went to Augusta, I noticed that her drinking elevated somewhat. When we got to up to Baltimore and lived, Gay drank with regularity. And I noticed when I would come home, when I did on the weekends, that she was different and she drank a lot more. I even asked her one time why she had to have a drink in her hand for us to communicate and talk, because that's the only way that anything, it wasn't communication, any words flowed between us. I continued to work at this job that turned out to be not quite the job that I thought it was going to be. We built three radio stations in short order, and the manager for this entertainer died of a heart attack. I should have taken a note of that, but I didn't. And I woke up one morning and I was managing his career, traveling with him. The radio stations fell by the wayside, and this people pleasing, I've gotten out of a job that I don't think that I belong in. I'm there by mistake, and I'm certainly into management of this entertainer by mistake. I had no idea, so I had to learn on the job. But this feeling of wanting something that I didn't know what I wanted, being somebody that I didn't know, continued to grow. The people-pleasing, the lying. I can remember we were talking sports one time, I played baseball, and I was a pitcher in a little semi-pro league down in Florida, and I threw a pitch to a guy one day that he hit dead center field about 100 feet over the center field fence. The catcher came out and said, "Don't worry, this guy used to play with the Cleveland Indians. He's a good ball player." So from that point on, I related to the guys that I used to play with the Cleveland Indians. And so whatever I could do to belong or make you like me or make you think that I was something other than what I really was, because I truly did not know who I was or what I was. The people-pleasing got to such a point that when I went to work for this entertainer, he was on the president's council against drug abuse. And we made some trips to Washington and worked in this area. And the problem is that he fell victim to the very thing that he fought for so many years as an entertainer. And my people-pleasing grew to such a height that, to explain to you a little about it, when we'd take a European tour, he'd say to me, bring me a little something back over when you come from the States. Now, you know what they do with people when you put things in your suitcases that shouldn't be there and they catch you. You go away for a long time. I didn't even use the stuff. And I was putting it in my bag to take to Europe to him because it would please him. And I came into Venice, into the airport one day, and I had some stuff in my bag. It was raining real hard, and there was a conveyor belt that took your bags down, and there was a guy standing there with two German shepherds at the end of that conveyor belt. And I said to the guy on the plane, who the only other fellow there that spoke English, what are they doing? He said, they're looking for drugs. And I swear that dog stopped on top of my suitcase when it went by there. But he didn't find it, because they had told me how to fix it. And don't ask me after the talk, because I'm not going to share it with you. not find it, and they didn't find it. And I made one of those let's make a deal prayers with God that we all make from time to time. Let me out of this one, God, and I promise you I won't do this again. And I really meant that one. I did not. I did not do that again. But I became aware of just what ends that I would go to in thinking in retrospect to that. I traveled around, ran around, and stayed on the road and gated our drinking, and we moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And things were not getting any better with me, as she said. And I came home to find out that that Gay had joined a group called Alcoholics Anonymous. I became very concerned that she was going to drag the family name through something like this. Because nobody knew about the IRS or the FBI or all the other stuff. But she was going, so I tried to talk her out of it, and she would hear none of it. And I was staying on the road, so I thought when I came home, best I go check out these people and see what she's gotten involved in. So I went to some open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with her. And I didn't see my grandfather there. I didn't see the people that I thought were drunks or alcoholics. What I saw were a bunch of beautiful faces, like I see here this morning. So I started to go to the meetings. Now, it was suggested to me that as a spouse of an alcoholic that I may want to try the fellowship of Al-Anon. And at Glen Haven Stone Mountain, Al-Anon met in a little room upstairs, and the alcoholics met in the big room downstairs. So I did. I got caught one night. I didn't want to go up to that little room upstairs. But I got caught by this woman, and she said, come on up and join us. Now I walked into that room. There were six little old ladies wearing tennis shoes sitting around talking about cleaning their house or whatever they talked about. I left that in short order and came back down, and I told Gay, I said, I don't ever want to be involved with that again. I'm not going back to that meeting. I'm not interested in being in Alcoholics Anonymous auxiliary, and I'll stay down here. But you know how drunks are when they love to tell their war stories. We used to go out after the open AA meetings to Denny's and sit around and drink coffee, and I'd listen to their war stories. Now, I'm one of those alcoholics who drank, I started to say, Bo, if you had been at the right meeting at the right time in Atlanta, you would have seen me. I'll tell you about it. I began to listen to them. I began to identify with the things they talked about. They talked about fear. Then they started telling their real war stories where they got drunk and they got beat up and they went to sleep in the street and they wrecked a car. I did all those things. I drank. I drank with Gay, around her, with her. Tried to outdrink her, tried to stay with her. The only difference is that I know today that the alcohol in those days would do the same thing for me not the same thing, it would do the same thing to me, not the same thing for me, as it did for Gay. It would do the same thing to me. If a monkey drinks enough, he'll fall out of the tree. And I drank, and I passed out. And I would wake up in bad condition the next morning. The problem is, the difference is, I didn't want to see that damn stuff anymore, and Gay wanted another drink. Because it would do the same thing to you. So I identify with the war stories. Then the wise alcoholics in that room said, "You're in the wrong place. You belong in this big room with us down here. All you got to do is give me a suggestion where you want me to be and what you want me to do, and I'll head out there." So I waited for the largest meeting that I had ever been to in Atlanta. It was in a cathedral downtown. And they always give out the chips at the end of the meeting. And then he said, "Anybody want a white chip?" And I said, "I do." And I ran down the aisle and I got a white chip. And so, yes, Blue, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried my damnedest for the next 3 years to be an alcoholic. But I'm here to tell you that it's this Al-Anon's belief that if you are an alcoholic, AA works very well for you. If you're not, it doesn't. I was not, and it didn't. The more I went to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the worse I got. I was traveling overseas, I'd run over and drink a little wine, come back to an AA meeting. And things were getting worse with the job. I kept driving to work on Monday morning saying, "This is it. This is the end of this relationship. I quit this job. I'm going to go down and fess up with the IRS and tell them that the $660,000 they're trying to collect from me and those taxes that I'm supposed to have filed for the last 5 years are going to be done. And I'm going to settle this problem. And I'm going to call the FBI and I'm going to give them the information they want and I'm going to be out of this. And I'm not going to worry about people repossessing my cars. And I'm not going to worry about people attaching my bank accounts." And the next Monday morning, I'd be driving to work saying the same thing again. I couldn't get out of it. I couldn't walk away from it. I couldn't turn it loose. And I walked in one night, and Gay had that serious look on her face. They talk about this grim determination that an Al-Anon has, that thin lip grim determination. I got news for you. When an alcoholic makes up their mind, they got much the same look on their face. And she said, "Sit down, we got to talk. I've made up my mind about something. By the right of being sober, I don't have to live like this anymore. And I've taken out divorce papers, and I'll thank you to go down and sign them, and we'll end this relationship and get on with our life." And I did what any other self-respecting man will do in that situation. I begged, I pleaded, and nothing worked. In the day before I was to sign the final papers to be divorced, I was down in Augusta and developed some pains in my arm and in my side of my head and my neck, and ended up in the hospital in intensive care for about 2 weeks. The doctor said I was having a heart attack, and Gay said that she was told that I should not receive any undue pressures at that point. Let me tell you what really happened in that situation. Gay walked into that hospital room, and I'm hooked up on all these machines. These little beepers are going off, and I'm sitting there thinking, this is the end, and I'm going to die. This is the end of it. And Gay very lovingly put both hands on her hips, and she said, "I hope like hell you don't think this changes my mind about anything I'm going to do." And it didn't, but I'll tell you what did change in that hospital room. I changed in that hospital room. I came face to face with a God of my understanding, and I hit my bottom there. And I got down on my knees beside that hospital bed, and I asked for God's help. And I hit my bottom, and I knew in my innermost self who I was and what I was. And I didn't know what to do, but I was willing to give it to the only place I knew, and that was to a God of my understanding, and one that I had been away from for a long, long time. It was a long time from that bed on my knees to the time back when I was going to be a Methodist minister as a young kid going to church every time the door opened. But that's where my life had come. I don't know why Gay and I didn't know, as she said last night, that my job being less than reputable, she had the insurance. at her job that it would pay whether or not we lived together or not. But she said, you can come home and you can stay until the insurance is settled. And I did. I didn't go back to that job. I didn't trust myself to go back to that job. I knew if I walked back in that door that I'd be driving back to work if Monday morning with those same resolves. So I just told them whatever belonged to me to pack it up and put it in a box, send it to me, because I wasn't coming back. They kept my office locked for 6 months saying, he's coming back, but he never did, because I knew I couldn't. And it took 10 months for that hospital bill to be paid. And I went to a wise fellow, and he said to me, you know, what you need to do is you need to work on yourself and leave Gay alone and leave the relationship alone. This relationship started with two separate whole individuals. If it ends, it's important that two separate whole individuals walk away from it. And the only way that you can do that is work on yourself and let her work on herself. As a result, if a relationship comes from that, then it's healthy and God-given. If it's not supposed to be, it won't. And that's what I did. I went back, and the only bad part about it is I had to go back into that little old room up there where those six little old ladies with those tennis shoes are on. But I tell you something, second trip up, I didn't notice the tennis shoes, and they were talking about something different. I heard something different when I went back up there that time. And I heard, and I joined in, and I began to go to Al-Anon. And I don't know, you know, to this day, and I just think about it, I never have asked Gay where those papers are. Maybe she's still holding on to them in case it doesn't work. But the conversation about that was never brought up, and we began to work on ourselves, and things began to go together for us. And we began to put a relationship together that I'd never had before. You know, we talk about recovery, and recovery denotes finding something that's been lost and get it back. And it was a little more than that for me, because these were things that I never had. It gave me a life that I never had. It wasn't a recovery so much to me as it was giving me a new life and a set of directions to live by. And I started to go in. And you know, some of those ladies that were in that little old room still go to my home group, and they remind me about the first time. Every time I see them, I remind myself about that first time when I go in. As Gay said, when we began to put our lives together, some things began to happen with our kids that were difficult. Packing Allison up in those green garbage bags and putting her on the back porch and saying to her, when she came home and asked what about her room, to say to her, you don't live here anymore, was a tough road. With Lori, to sit in court with her and see her lose the kids and want to do something, want to be able to do something, want to be powerful enough to do something to help them and know that you can't, is a tough road. And old Jack, who's gone now, used to sit, and he said, the only thing you can do for them is the example you set by the life you live, and that's all you can do for them. And we tried to take that to heart, and we tried to set a better example. And as we began to grow, we had some wonderful opportunities in this program. I can remember after Gay first came in the program, my dad came up to visit with us, and it was a real problem. I didn't know how do you tell your dad, who has taken care of his father, who was a gutter drunk, that your wife is an alcoholic and she's in AA. And we didn't know how to tell him, so we decided not to tell him. That's the best thing to do. We just leave it alone. God has a wonderful sense of humor. We were sitting, Dad and I, at 12:30 at night in the middle of a snowstorm watching television, and the girls have gone to bed. The phone rings. Gay answers it back in the bedroom, gets up and gets dressed, and out the door she goes. You look at your dad, and then what do you tell him in the middle of a snowstorm, in the middle of the night? Your wife has just left. And I said, Dad, she's gone on what's called a 12-step call, and she is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he smiled, and he said, she's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? I thought you had the drinking problem. And he became a great fan of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And he began to, when he would visit us, he would come to meetings. And we went to a meeting one night, he and I, and Gay was sick and couldn't go. It was an anniversary at Clarkston. And we went and set the chairs up, and we were driving back. And I knew right then that the opportunity had presented itself for me to make those amends that I had been working on. And we drove along, and I spent the time with him, and I made the amends to him. And I told him how I felt, which opened the door for him to make some amends to me. And we both made our amends, and he pulled out of his wallet that night a letter that I had written him when I was 14 years old. And it said how much I disliked him and how much he did not love me because he wouldn't give me something I had asked for. Now, I'm in my late 40s. I wrote that letter when I was 14 years old. He'd been carrying around his wallet since then. He took that out of his wallet and he threw it away. We made our amends. Gay was speaking down in Savannah, and we were down there, and we got a call that my mother was seriously ill, and if I wanted to see her, that I better come in. So we made a decision to get out of the conference, and we grabbed everything in the car, and we headed for Virginia, and we drove, and I prayed all the way that, please God, let Mom live long enough for me to get there and make the amends that I want to make to her. And I got there, and they'd taken her out of intensive care, and they put her in this little room where the family could visit with her. And she was still alive, and I went in, and I got it on my knees. I closed the door, and I made my amends to her. Again, God's got a sense of humor. Mom decided not to die. She lived, and she told the doctors the next day, I fooled you, didn't I? And they said, yeah. And I was able, that allowed me, my stepfather was killed in an automobile accident shortly thereafter. And she was put into a nursing home. And I can remember as a young kid telling Mother, don't, when she would say, I'm concerned how you're going to turn out without a father. Don't worry, Mom, I'm going to grow up, you'll be a big boy, make some money, and I'm going to take care of you. Well, I had an opportunity to bring Mom down to Atlanta, put in a nursing home very close to the house. She had a chance to see her grandkids. She had a chance to see great-grandkids that she'd never seen before. We had a chance to spend the holidays with her, Christmas and Thanksgiving. We have her at our house. And several years ago on Mother's Day, we had a big outing planned for Mother out at the nursing home. And I went by that night before Mother's Day, and she wasn't responding too well to the nurses. And I stood at the foot of the bed, and she heard my voice. And it was like a moment of clarity. She opened her eyes, and she sat up in bed, and she said, you know I love you, don't you? And I said, yeah, you know I love you. And she died. Our family is a great one for picking holidays to leave on. Gay's mom left on Thanksgiving, Mom left on Mother's Day, so the holidays take a special significance for us at times. But these are some of the miracles that I have been given through this program of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. My kids that were in so much trouble when I was not there and didn't have a hand in raising them. Gay did all that by herself. God has given me a wonderful thing called Al-Ateen, and I've become an Al-Ateen sponsor, and I can work with these kids and I can spend time with these kids. And to hear these kids come in there dressed up in leathers and chains and talk about love and acceptance, it's a wonderful gift. It's a wonderful gift. Been also given another God-given opportunity, and that's to have grandchildren that old Blue talked about over there. We kid about it. Oh, what a deal. We had three daughters. The first three grandchildren that we had were all girls. I thought we had lost the recipe for a long time in the Garner family. But the last one was a little fellow by the name of Josh. And I'd like to tell you that Joshua is not spoiled. I'd like to tell you that. But I'd be lying to you, you see, because Josh is. And I get to go to ball games with Josh. Planned, I think, next week or the week after to go see the Hawks play. And we hang out together and we love each other. And I get to be a part of their life. And that's a real gift. Another gift and another miracle that the program of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous has given us is a relationship that we never had before. Didn't know how to have before. And we spent about 25 years wanting to get out of that relationship, figuring out a way out of it, but neither one of us willing to do what needed to be done to break up that relationship. So we hung in there. I forgot to tell you that when I announced to Gay that when she let me know that we were going to be divorced, I told her that I said, I'm really not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, we've known that for years. But she let me make the mistakes that I needed to make and do the things that I needed to do. And we worked on each other, and I get upset sometimes. There's a wonderful marriage ceremony that you probably have all seen where they have three candles, and they take the two candles and light the one, and they blow out the other ones, and I said, that's not the way it's supposed to be. There's supposed to be two burning candles there, and Gay always punches me and tells me to shut up. But it was important that we work on ourselves and that two whole human beings come out of this relationship. And that's what happened. And little by little, and we continue to work on it today, we have a relationship and we will be married soon, 40 years. And so we thank God, hung in there long enough to experience these miracles, because all the miracles in my life that I've told you about this morning, I would have missed had it not been for this program. If it not had been for this program and the channels by which I received it, those six little old ladies with tennis shoes in that room up there, Glen Haven Stone Mountain, which is now closed and gone, but some of the ladies have moved over. And I used to look around, and I used it as a real excuse for not going to some of these meetings because there were no men there. And if you're a man Al-Anon, don't let that throw you, okay? These ladies saved my life, and they continue to save my life today. And it's just like when we take the alcohol away, I firmly believe that we are all alike as far as the disease is concerned. It doesn't make any difference. The only difference is that we don't share our experience, strength, and hope in our sponsorship. But other than that, we are all alike when it goes to these meetings. I find what I'm looking for in these meetings. And that's where my life has been saved. That's where I know my help is. And I can get involved and get away from those meetings for a week or two with those ladies and with my home group. And I can read all the literature in the world. And I can listen to all the tapes. Nothing replaces walking through those doors, sitting down in those rooms, and sharing in that spirit of oneness that exists there for me. It's just there's no replacement for it. I love coming to the roundups. I love particularly the smaller roundups like this, because you really feel like you get to meet everybody and you feel like you're a part of it and you're not set apart from. Because I know today, anywhere I go, that I'm right where I should be, doing exactly what I should be doing. I'm not there by mistake. I don't belong anywhere else other than where I am. It's where the God of my understanding chooses for me to be, and I'm very acceptable when it comes to that, because that's where I want to be. I got up and walked around these buildings this morning, and I thought about it, and what a wonderful gift this is, that we can come together and share and be a part of this oneness and be a part of this fellowship. And it's amazing. Gay said that she hopes that the fellowships remain for anybody until such a time as they need them, that we're always here. And that's happened for my family, it's happened for my daughters, it's happened for us. And I hope that these Alateens that we sponsor and involved, it will continue to happen for them. So if you have, let me pitch for that for just a second. If you have an opportunity to become an Alateen sponsor, if you are in Al-Anon and somebody asks for help in a Alateen sponsorship, don't shortchange yourself. Try it. It's a wonderful opportunity, as this has been this weekend. I thank you very much for allowing us to be here, to be a part of your roundup. And we plan to come back next year. And I'm sorry I won't be seeing any meetings, Blue, but I love you all. Thank you very much.